Hi, my name is Sam Van Horn.
Hi, Sam.
Okay. And I've been a grateful member of Al-Anon since November 7th of 1994. And I'd like to thank the committee for having me out here today, for Pauline being a great host. Had a really great time, got here yesterday, went to Montoya's with her husband Mike and Jim, had a really good dinner. Really enjoyed the speakers I've heard last night and today. You know, and I'm the Al-Anon speaker. I really, you know, it's great being the Al-Anon speaker because you get to hear Joe B. talk about, you know, going to jail and coming back from jail and going to jail, and or Julie being married four times before 30, and you're just going to hear about a guy that just kind of thinks too much going up here. And and I do also want to just take a moment to thank the committee, the whole committee, for working on this convention. I know that many people put a lot of work into this convention months before people even thought about coming here. And I just want people to the committee to know that I really appreciate all the work that happens. And also the tapers. I'm someone who's benefited a whole lot from the experience, strength, and hope from people that I would never have come into contact with had it not been for people that tape. That go to conventions and do that work. So I also, very very grateful for the for people that do that as well. And and I worked on a committee myself when an AA convention in Iowa. And when you're in Al-Anon, there are just a few things they let you do. And one of them is to organize the hospitality room. I was hospitality chair, and one of the duties I had was to ensure that the 100 cup coffee maker had enough coffee. I remember before the main meeting, that I think it was Clancy who was speaking that year, and I had a lot of coffee, and the alcoholics were filing into that hospitality room, and they don't bring 8-ounce styrofoam cups. They have the 16-ounce cups, the big service station cups, and I was watching that kind of meter go down and down. And for years, thanks to Al-Anon, I had been relieved of the obsession with how much an alcoholic drinks. But I do want you to know that obsession came right back. This disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And so I grew up in a normal alcoholic home. My father drank all the time. My mother was angry, and my brother and I were scared. And there's just really nothing exceptional about it. I remember some of my earliest memories were at family dinners. And at family dinners, my mother insisted we all sit down and have dinner together. And I remember that my father started the dinner awake and upright, but at some point during dinner, he would pass out in his chair. And what was interesting about my reaction was that I went on with dinner acting as if nothing had happened. And my mother, my brother, and I just went on talking, and my mom would clean up the kitchen, turn off the lights, and we would leave him there in his chair overnight. And we just didn't. We also took that on the road. We took that to family dinners, extended family dinners, where my father would pass out at big tables. And and I just remember feeling so ashamed and so embarrassed that happened in my family. And I didn't know why my father drank the way that he did. And I thought that if he really wanted to, if he really loved us, he could stop drinking. My father is an Episcopal minister, and we went to his church growing up. And again, when I would go up to communion at my father's church, I noticed that you would hardly have to actually tip the chalice to get any wine. The chalice, he would fill it completely to the brim. And I remember sitting back in the pews and communion would be over, and I watched my mom. Early on, I was always watching other people's reactions to see how I should feel and read these situations. And after the communion would be over, my father, he'd be behind the altar, and you would watch him just slowly down that entire... And I knew there would be an argument. I knew there would be a fight on the way home, and that's kind of how it always went. And eventually what happened to my father was there was an intervention, and people showed up from, his colleagues, and they asked him if he wanted to go into treatment. And he agreed to go into treatment. I was about 10 years old at the time. And he went to a treatment center for 3 months. And after going into treatment, and to this day, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, my father's never had another drink of alcohol. And for that, I'm very grateful for that. But, him in treatment, I remember, was just this, was just this, we would go visit him. There were these family meetings on the weekends. We would pile into the car. We would get cigarettes and books and, you know, pack these things in the car. I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii, and the treatment center was on the countryside of the island. It was about a half-hour drive, which for Hawaii is like days. So, you know, we would pack all these things in, and we would drive over to the treatment center, and we would give, you know, they had these family meetings, but my brother and I, we went out and we played basketball or ran around on the grounds. I just didn't really want any part of anything that was going on inside those rooms. And my father was in there over Christmas, and I remember that we were there on Christmas Eve, and my father had a little bit of a communion for us with grape juice, and I remember looking at my mom, and she was crying. She was so relieved and happy about what was going on, and I remember just feeling nothing. I remember feeling that I was due, you know, that for him to stop drinking. And and then when he came home from treatment, we were, things just went on, and I thought alcoholism was over because alcoholism was drinking. And my father no longer drinks, therefore alcoholism is over. And his life started to get better. He was now no longer passed out in chairs. He was going to meetings. He was going to AA meetings every night. So he was gone. And that was when I started to develop new resentments. So my father was gone all the time. And I really wanted him to be around. And his life started to get better. But I had the family disease of alcoholism. And my life started just to get progressively stranger and weirder. And, you know, I went into high school doing the things that high school kids do, but a little differently. And, you know, it's just kind of a good example about how my mind works was I grew up in Hawaii. I wanted to be like the popular people. I want to learn how to surf. So I found someone who gave me a surfboard. And you would think if you were learning how to surf, you would go to a small beach where the waves are close to shore. But I decided to take a surfboard, and I'm going to go out to Diamond Head, where the waves are 200, 300 yards out. So that's where people go. I took the surfboard. I got into the water. I paddled all the way out there. And by the time I get out there, I just realized I don't know how to surf. I really don't know how to do this. And I turn around, I start to paddle back in, and I can't get back in, and I think I'm going to die out there. And I'm sure I did what I did, many times. Is I imagine my own funeral, and I imagine all the people that have harmed me at school, how sad they're going to be that I drowned out here, and eventually I make it back, and I'm exhausted. And you know what? I never tried surfing again because it just doesn't work. I went to Hawaii with my wife a couple years ago, and she said, "Look, they have surfing lessons. You could ask someone to teach you." Like, what a concept. And early on, the speakers talked about it tonight and last night and today. You know how they felt different, and they never felt like they belonged. And I want you to know that I had that same. I never felt like I belonged. I just felt like there was a tutorial on how to live life, and how to be. How to be okay in your own skin. And I just wasn't there. I just wasn't there for that day. And in school. But I clearly fixated on someone who would fix me. And her name was Carrie. And I knew that she would be my solution. She didn't even know that I existed, though I was completely infatuated with her. And I would sit at home in my room, and I would feel sorry for myself and feel sad and feel the victim. And I had a 45, for those of you who are very young, that's a disc with a hole in the middle. And I put it on a turntable with a needle where music came out of. And I would put that, my 45 was Phil Collins, Against All Odds. And I would put that on the record player, and I would lie in my bed and cry. And, I'd have to get up and put it back on. And I'm really grateful that I came into, that I grew up in the 80s, because if I had grown up with those unlimited playlists, you might have a different speaker. I just might not have ever come out of that room. And I would just feel sorry for myself. And, my family and I, occasionally I knew where she lived, and we would drive, and I recorded it on a tape on my Walkman, and I would cue it up, and I would play it when we drove past her house. And I was just so self-centered, self-involved from day one. But from my perspective, it was just, she doesn't know me. She doesn't treat me well enough. I mean, I could always find, for whatever problem I had, I could always blame someone else. I could always put it on someone. And clearly, life in Hawaii wasn't working out for me well enough. And I kind of do want to stop and say that, after my father got sober and with things, in high school, things were not going well for me at all. And I remember my brother and I, we fought all the time. And we had one of these fights one day that was really bad. And he ran away from me, and he ran into his room, and he locked the door, and I kicked it down. you know, and I want you to know that my father, but he had been sober for 5 years then, and yeah, and when I did my inventory years later, I realized that I was the perpetrator of physical violence in the home. My grandfather was, I don't know if he was alcoholic or not. Today I know that alcoholism is a self-diagnosed disease, but I was told that he drank a lot, and he and my grandmother had divorced before I was born. And essentially what happened was I was told that he was a horrible person, and so we spent all many times holidays with my grandmother, and I maybe saw my grandfather once a year, and I just was taught that he was a bad person, and so I just kind of inherited a resentment of him, and it must have been because of his own drinking. And all these things are going on in me, and you know, and my father had recommended that I go to Alateen. I knew what Alateen was. We would occasionally go to these AA events, but I just wanted no part of that because I had no ability to look at myself and realize that maybe I had something to do with my problems. And so, growing up in Hawaii, not working for me, I'm always glad to move. And so when I went to college, I'm going to go to Illinois, and because that's where and I picked that place because no one from my high school was going there, and it'd be a fresh start. And sure, it was. When I got there, I was the guy from Hawaii. There was nobody there from Hawaii, and at parties, I was the guy that stood out, and people liked me. And I think Clancy puts it. I've never heard anybody put it as well as he does when he says, If you're going to be in my life, all I ask from you is that you treat me special all the time. And if you treat me special, I feel average. But when you treat me average, I feel rejected. And that described me to perfectly. And eventually, I'm just one of the bunch. And hi Sam. And as soon as they just say it that way, I know it's the beginning of the end. And I was a regular college student. I drank in college and I had a good time and went to parties. And before I went to college, my father was, he would say to me, you should be careful about alcoholism and alcohol. There's alcoholism in your family. And so when I went drinking with my friends, I would drink, and then I would ask myself, well, do I feel like I have to have another drink? I just kept drinking, and I didn't think that I was alcoholic. And again, because I thought that alcoholism was just alcohol. And eventually, living in Illinois, and I just get this answer, why don't I go to Russia and live in Russia? That's a different place. And so I became a Russian major, and I went to Russia to study abroad and to work. While I'm there, I meet a her. Always have to find a her. And the thing about her is, I don't know if she ever liked me very much, but she always seemed to like me more when I bought her lacquered barrettes. In Russia, the lacquered jewelry is a big thing, and I knew where you could buy all these lacquered barrettes and where I was living. And when she just didn't seem to like me very much, I would just go shopping for lacquered barrettes. That's the way I have relationships, is that I have to continually find a way that I can do things to you so that you'll like me. And eventually what happened was, in order for me to stay there, I needed school ended, and I decided, I want to try to make this relationship work. And so I found a job, and the job I found was being a guard at the American consulate in St. Petersburg. And I want you to know that I'm no bigger than I was then. I'm not guard material at all. And the only reason why I got that job was because at the interview they asked me in Russian, I put a bomb there, and I told them I could understand that. So I got the job. I had a part of my job there was I had a mirror on a long pole, and I would take it to the consul's car, and I would go under the car and look for explosives that were possibly placed there. And I know how to do that. I'm trained on how to search a car for bombs, in case you're interested. I would patrol the outside. And one day I'm standing outside in front of the consulate, and I look down the street, and there's protesters with hammer and sickle flags, and they're coming for me. And I wondered to myself, how do I get here? And I really wish I was alcoholic, because I could say something like, I took a drink, I drank all night, and I woke up in wherever. I'm a pre-Al-Anon. All I have to do is think, and I think that's a great idea. I'm gonna go there. I really wish I could blame alcohol for all these crazy decisions, but I completely make all these decisions stark raving sober. And When pretty soon it came time for me to leave and return to the United States. While I was in that consulate, one day I'm working at the desk, and I reach my hand in the desk, and I feel something poke me, and I take my hand out, and I think, well, that's I wonder what that was. A few days go by and I can't bend my finger, and it's starting to swell. And I had this Russian doctor friend of mine, and she says, well, you need to take care of that. And she gave me pins and hydrogen peroxide, and I start jabbing at my finger, trying to drain this wound. And eventually it just crusts over with black blood, and it's time for me to fly back from St. Petersburg, Russia, all the way back to the States. And, I get to Holland, and I get to Amsterdam in the airport, and my finger by now looks so bad that there's a nurse, won't come closer to me than Alan right there, and asks me, if I'm okay, if I need some help. And I say, I'm fine. I'm fine. I get on the plane in London, and again, they send some medical personnel onto the plane to talk to me and ask me if I need some help, because right now it's because the blood is now crusting up all over my finger, and I tell them I'm okay. And when the plane gets to New York, to JFK, while I'm getting off the plane, I hit my hand on something, and it just bursts, and blood just starts pouring all down my arm. And the two Port Authority police officers pick me up, and they put a bandage on my hand, and they take me to a medical center, and they bring me in, and they say, this guy just got back from the Soviet Union, and something's wrong with his hand. And I stop and say, it's actually not the Soviet Union anymore, it's Russia. Because I'm in a serious medical condition, but I'm much more concerned that we get the geopolitical names and labels correct. And I have always been that way. Faced with a problem in my life, I have always much preferred to focus on some distraction or minutia as opposed to look at what's actually going on in my life. And what happened was I had probably been bit several days before by a brown recluse spider in that consulate. And the doctors told me that it's just a miracle that I didn't lose my finger or my hand or something worse that could have happened to me. So I got back to Illinois, and I needed to finish college, and I found a roommate that was set up to me. And this roommate that I hit it off with, he drank too much. Oh my, how would I find someone like that? I don't know. And he would do things like he would drink, I would wake up in the morning and the phone would be pulled out of the wall and there'd be vomit in the bathroom. And he said it wasn't him, but there's only two of us living there. And it just something inside of me just seemed to snap, and I felt like I was 10 years old again, and that my parents were fighting in the other room, and I was terrified. I would lie awake at night wondering what I'd find the next morning, and I did something which I never did before, which was I called my father and I asked him what to do. And I never told my parents anything about what was ever going on in my life. The way they learned about my life was when I was living in Europe and traveling around, was when they saw the credit card bill pop up in Turkey, they would say, oh, Sam's been to Turkey, because I was just never told them things I was doing. That relationship didn't work out when I got back. It was her fault. She wasn't treating me special enough. I broke up with her over email when email was really new. Because, of course, I can't do anything to your face. I have no courage. I can't actually make that decision, do that in front of you. And my father suggested I go to an Al-Anon meeting. I looked up Al-Anon in the phone book, and I found Al-Anon. I found the meeting at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Urbana, Illinois, and I went to my first meeting, and I walked down into the church basement, and there were a lot of guys in leather and tattoos, and I knew enough from my father's time in AA that I didn't think this was Al-Anon. And sure enough, they pointed me over to this kitchen. Where, there were, and they said the Al-Anon meeting is in there. And I have to say that to this day, as an Al-Anon member, I have this intuitive knack. Whenever I go to a new meeting, if it's in a church or a school, you just look for the smallest room in the building. And that's where you find the Al-Anons, huddled over their table and their daily readers. And sure enough, and I want you to know that when I was so scared as I pushed, I remember walking into that door. And I had no clue what I was going to find on the other side. All I knew was that, that I didn't like my life anymore. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I went into that meeting and I sat down. And I don't remember what they talked about. But what I remember was that people nodded their heads when I talked. And which is usually people did this when I talked. And I just started going back to that meeting. And I felt would feel better at that meeting. And people talked to me. And they gave me a meeting list and a newcomer's packet. And on my own, I read that newcomer's packet, and what I thought it said was that you throw the alcoholic out. you know, I interpreted the literature on my own, and to this day I know that Al-Anon literature is better interpreted through a sponsor. But at that time, so I came back to him, I said, you know, we shouldn't be roommates anymore, and we ended up subletting the apartment to two drug dealers who wouldn't pay the rent. And I heard a speaker say this, I wish I could give credit to the speaker, but it's the biggest truth for me then, and it's true for me today, is that the problems in my life are not the problems in my life. The problems in my life are the solutions I think of when I believe I'm addressing problems in my life. Those have always been the major problems, and this was a major problem. And that was when I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor because now I have a real issue going on here. I have, you know, two leases and I don't have a job. And my father was always harassing me to get a sponsor anyway. He always would, whenever I called, he'd say, do you have a sponsor yet? Do you have a sponsor? And I didn't know what a sponsor was, and I didn't even want to ask. I just assumed a sponsor was someone who paid for his treatment. You know, kind of like race car drivers have sponsors. I guess alcoholics going into treatment have sponsors. And so I eventually went to a meeting. Someone said, go to this other meeting. There's someone there that you might like. And I went to this meeting, and there was a man there. And he was laughing. He was happy. And when he talked about the program, I knew that he knew me. I knew that I could maybe trust this person. I asked him to be my sponsor. Had I known what I was going to get into when I found a sponsor, I would not have got that person as a sponsor. Because, you know, immediately he had me doing things. He had me calling every day for 3 weeks. And I did that. And you know what? After calling him every day for 3 weeks, it was easy to call my sponsor, and I knew his phone number. He said, "We're gonna work the steps. We're gonna have step assignments, and we're gonna read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and work the steps out of the first 164 pages." And I'm really grateful. I didn't know enough to say, "Well, that's not conference-approved literature." And we started reading, and I would have assignments. I would read that book, and then we would get together and we would read it out loud together in the coffee shops. And at first, I'm reading it very quietly because, of course, I'm afraid that people are gonna what they're gonna think of me. But as I read that book, you know, he had me substitute the word thinking for drinking and alcoholism for alcohol, and I just realized it fit me perfectly. And what I realized was two things. First of all, was that I just totally misunderstood the disease of alcoholism. Was that when I looked at my father, I assumed my father had a drinking problem. If my father would just stop drinking, he would be better. And what I realized, alcoholism is a much more serious disease than that, and that my father had a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy, that he had a body that would say that once he put any alcohol into his body, he had a phenomenon of craving would hit him, and that which he would not be able to overcome. And there's that great line in the doctor's opinion. You know, I thought drinking was about escape, and it says that these men were not drinking to escape; they were drinking to overcome a phenomenon of craving beyond their mental control. And in that doctor's opinion, I could see what my father had, and I could see that was not his decision. You know, he did not set out to hurt us. My father was a sick person, and I resented a sick person. But even better for me was that I saw my problem. It was that, and when I substitute the word thinking for drinking, it made complete sense to me. You know, we are people who have lost the ability to control our thinking. I mean, that just described, I could see why I would start off in Hawaii and end up as a guard at a consulate in Russia, just because I just made that decision in my mind. Which is why sponsorship is really critical for a person like me, because ideas that are going to kill me come to my mind sounding like common sense. And they come to my mind sounding like common sense today. So, you know, we got into, you know, and we worked the steps, and for me, you know, for many of you, perhaps, you know, going to having a higher power is a simple thing, but when I started seeing God and reading about that, I had to think, well, I have to go back to that God where I watched my father, you know, drink all that wine behind the altar and then have one life at church and then one life at home, and there was no way I could ever go back to that. And I'm really grateful that when we did the steps, my sponsor had me, you know, when we would read the Big Book together, where it said, read the, when it talked about Bill, when Bill writes about the spiritual experience, he says, look at the spiritual appendix. And, you know, so we would go back and we would turn to the spiritual appendix and we read that section where we talked about, you know, that many spiritual awakenings were of the educational variety, that I didn't have to have this white light experience that Bill writes about in Bill's story, and that all I needed was honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I could start on a simple level, and I could define my own conception of God, and it was literally that way for me, just by starting to say like simple prayers, asking God for help, and these things, and and when it came time to do my, you know, to do my third step, you know, I took my, when I took my third step, you know, I felt something. I took my third step with my sponsor on, you know, on our knees together in his apartment, and you know, and I, and as soon as I got up, it was literally, he had the directions for the four step inventory on the table. You know, it was like, you get up and I'm okay, great, I can pause, and but there's no pause. And sure enough, it says in the big book that we have to, you know, that this decision does, you know, is an important decision, but it's not going to mean much if I don't set out on a vigorous course of action to get rid of those things that are blocking my relationship with a higher power. And so I immediately got my directions for an inventory, and you know, I worked on that resentment list, and you know, would hide it under my bed every night, and for some reason I thought someone would come in looking for my inventory. I did hear at my Al-Anon meetings of a friend in Al-Anon who did find her boyfriend's inventory, and so I did kind of wonder, well, no one can find this, and my sponsor said, he said, you know, write that inventory as if no one else is going to read it, just you, you know, and it was the first time I started to be completely honest with myself about my resentments. And And you know, and as I wrote my inventory, I wrote these things down. I could, you know, with the four column method, you know, I had the, you know, I would write down, you know, that I bought that girlfriend extra barrettes, and she didn't, you know, my resentment. Well, she didn't, you know, treat me any better, and you know, and then of course I had to add that fourth column, and I hate the fourth column. you know, I love the picture in the big book. It's the only picture in the big book, and they messed it up, right? It's just three columns in the picture. And you know, but when I add the fourth column, you know, what's my part? What did I do to set that ball rolling? And I could see, you know, it was my expectation, you know, that doing this, I would get the result that I want. And when I went through all my resentments, I could see that even if it didn't start with me, it was my attitudes, it was my own disease that just perpetuated all of that. And and it came time to do my fifth step, and you know, the biggest resentment I had was towards my father. You know, my father drank too much. My father hurt us. My father wasn't there for us. And you know, and I'm going through this, and my sponsor stopped me, and he said, you know, didn't you always, you know, have a place to live and shelter? You know, and didn't you always have food to eat? You know, and my father sent me to. I went to private school, and my parents paid for my college education. And you know, my sponsor said to me, he said, you know, you may not have the father that you wanted, but you had the father that you needed. And when he said that to me, I could see that my resentment had twisted my view of my father, and that I hated someone that had a disease. And all of the good things that my father did for me, I somehow conveniently swept under the rug. When I went to college in Illinois, I thought I was being very brave, and you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to 5,000 miles away from home. But the day before they were supposed to go back, we were having dinner, and I sobbed, and I ran out of the restaurant, and my father came running out after me to comfort me and console me. You know, none of those things were in my inventory, none of those things that my father did for me to care for me. And that's what resentment does to me. You know, resentment, when a resentment says it's the number one offender, what it means in my interpretation is that it's offensive. It's kind of like the instant football, the football replay is how my mind works, is right. They say that, you know, the receiver gets hit by the defensive back, and they go, oh, let's watch that again. And what happens in my mind is that as I do that, and every time I replay that in my mind, I don't know that I'm doing this, but I make the other person just a little bit more evil, and I make myself just a little more innocent. And over years of doing that, by the time I'm completely blameless, and that person is completely in the wrong. And that's what resentment does for me today. And so I'm really, you know, those pages, when I have a resentment today, I turn quickly to the big book, and I turn quickly to that, because when I had that inventory and I looked at that, where it says that, you know, we were prepared to take, we, you know, what we saw was that the world and its people really dominated us. And I didn't really like that. I thought all these things I felt, you know, that did work. Like that resentment, that would change you. And then the line after that, where it says, "What you know, in that state, the wrongdoing of others, real or imagined, had power to actually kill." And that's, you know, what that really says to me is that absolutely nothing has to happen to me out here for me to die from the disease of alcoholism, because all I have to do is create something in my mind and get that and blame someone, but nothing really has to happen. I mean, that's the severity of my condition. So I worked the steps with that sponsor, and eventually what happened was I decided to go back to graduate school. I was working in a college bookstore, and I decided to go back to my master's in writing, and I went to Purdue from Illinois, and And I, you know, when I got there, you know, the Al-Anon, they didn't do it right there. And, you know, and I would chair meetings and I would say, you know, we're going to go around in a circle. We're not going to do this crazy crosstalk thing. And they kept doing what they were doing. And then success just started to become, you know, I had some success in my first year. I won this award. And success just started to creep back and become much more important. It became so much that when in my third year, when I was going to the mailbox, when they were sending out the notifications, I was shaking because I had to win. You know, I had to be the best. Again, it's, for me, it was all or nothing. It's either I'm the best around on campus or I'm the worst. And around that time, you know, I had a sponsor, but I wasn't really telling my sponsor. I wasn't really telling my sponsor things before I was doing them. Or I wasn't really telling my sponsor things at all. I had to have a surgery, and when I got the bill, someone I went to school with said, you know, well, you can claim your charity case. I have an inheritance, you know, that's set up, and I called the hospital and they asked me some questions. They didn't ask me the question where I thought I would tell them the truth, and because they didn't ask me that question, I didn't tell them about that money, and they claimed that was a charity case, and they waived all that money that I had to pay them for this surgery, and I justified that in my mind. And what happened was that after that time there at Purdue, you know, my program had just really changed, and it didn't change overnight, but it just changed slowly by putting success, wanting that to be the prime thing in my life. And when I finished there, I had a friend who was living in Iowa, and he said, why don't you move out here? And I moved out there. I didn't have a job, but the program was good, he said. So I moved out there, and thankfully I got active again, and I got a sponsor, and I picked a home group, and the Sunday, my home group, which I have to this day, it's the Sunday night Al-Anon Book Study in Iowa City. It's a great group, just like your home group is. And my sponsor asked for me to show up for meetings early, and you know, to dress like I am now for my home group meeting, just out of respect for the program that's saving my life. And I did that, and I got involved again. I got active. I started sponsoring men, and I got active in the service structure. And things started to get better. I had a part-time, but what happened for me was that I really loved being of service in Al-Anon, you know, and I loved, you know, newcomers in Al-Anon. There is to this day, there's no one I treat better in my life than a newcomer. You know, a newcomer walks in the door. You know, we all feel that way, I definitely felt that way. You know, greet them, make them feel welcome, And I got a job teaching part-time at the community college. And what happened for me was, you know, I was secretary for my home group, and I would spend more time on the flyers for my meeting than I would preparing for class. because, you know, it was hard to prepare for class. I was talking about my sponsor because I wasn't ready for class, and he said, yes. You know, he said, I know this about you. He said, you like to always do the easy thing. you know, and he was right, and something started to happen in terms of my teaching, was that my teaching evaluations were bad, and I wasn't changing. And then one day I'm walking past the dean's office, and there's three of my students in the dean's office, and they're complaining about me. And my solution at the time, the best solution I had at the time, was to take a detour so that when I came to work, I would not walk past the dean's office. I mean, that was the solution that I had to that problem. But thankfully, you know, thankfully I knew enough to know that when the you-know-what hits the fan, that I could turn to my sponsor. And when I saw that, when I saw what was going on in the dean's office, I went down the hall and I called my sponsor on a payphone. And I was just beside myself, because it's one thing for me to know, like, well, I'm not doing a good job. But for other people to know, you know, that type of humiliation or that shame, you know, I just couldn't live with that. And what my sponsor wanted me to do was to go directly into my dean's office and tell him that I knew that I had a problem and ask him what I could do to fix it. And I want you to know that that was not even a solution that had entered my mind until that phone call. And I say that because this has happened to me in my recovery, which is that surrender, you know, you hear surrender, like, yeah, surrender. And from what me, all surrender means in my experience is that I'm willing to take an action that I don't think is the right idea for my life. I mean, that's surrender, and at that moment, that was a test for me whether I was going to surrender, because that was not the thing I wanted. That was not what I thought was the right thing to do, but I did it anyway, because that's what I've heard here. And so I walked into the dean's office and I said, you know, I clearly have a problem here, and I want to do something about it. And he said, you know, I might not have been willing to work with you, but I'm willing to work with you because you came into here. And what I had to do was I had to find out how to become a teacher. And I had to do, you know, and my sponsor, I had to talk to other teachers. I had to find people, you know, and sit down with them and ask them what they do. And I learned about planning, and I learned about all these basic things that teachers learn to do that somehow I just think I should know how. I feel like I should just walk in some place and know how to do it without even asking. And, you know, I started working on my teaching. And what happened was my teaching evaluations, they started to get better, and they became, you know, I started to become like an average teacher. And they told me I was being reviewed in this, you know, off by a committee. And I knew the person who managed the student evaluations. And it had been, you know, after a couple of years of trying to do better, I came to him and I said, you know, am I still being reviewed? And he said, well, no, because you're off the you know what list now. and so when I decided to go back to him for my doctoral program, and when I left there, they actually asked me to stay and keep teaching. And so, you know, when I left there, I could leave that job feeling like I was not leaving a wreck or a mess. You know, I could leave looking people in the eye, and that's what this program has given me. This program has given me the ability in my life for when I totally mess up, that if I mess things up, if I follow directions, I can get back into being, you know, and live life and be a principled person. And, you know, and along the way, there were other things that I needed to clean up, and, you know, amends I didn't make. And I, you know, my grandfather, for example, was, you know, I couldn't, because I basically cut him out of my life and ignored him. And I heard Sharon Barker talk about sending cards to her father. You know, she owed her father all this money, and she would send all these notes to her father over the years. And so what happened was I started, you know, sending my grandfather, who by this time was in a nursing home, you know, I would send him like postcards for what I was doing, and I found out that he liked the National Geographic magazine, and so I sent him a subscription. And when I would go home to Hawaii, I would go visit him, and my family wouldn't visit him, and they told me he won't know you. And one of these years, you know, I walked in, I went to found out where he was, and I went to walk in, and he said, Samuel Alexander Van Horn. And he was a crusty, he was a Marine, and who was in the Pacific Theater in World War II. And I sat with him, and I would spend time with him, and I could see the good in him. And what I realized was that for all those years I hated him, I didn't even know who he was. And I don't know if he had this disease or not, but people here taught me how to be a son. People here taught me how to be an employee, and people here taught me how to be a grandson. And part of the basic thing about being a grandson is you visit your grandfather, and you do those loving things. And and what happened was a few years later, he died, and we were going through his things, and we found some of these postcards that I had sent him years ago. And when I saw those postcards, I knew the value of action in this program. You know, for me, I'm so arrogant that I just think that, you know, oh, I'm sorry. You should, you know, and everything should be fine. And you know, the power of action is that I take these little steps that are centered on someone else, that aren't centered on me, and the value of that can be tremendous over time. And when he had a funeral, because he was a veteran, he was interned at his ashes were interned at the memorial, you know, Punchbowl Cemetery in Hawaii, and they gave me his flag, and I have that flag today. And when I was becoming a better teacher, what happened was I learned how to use this specific technology at the community college where I was working, and that enabled me to get a job supporting other. While I was doing my doctoral program, my day job was to support other instructors who were using this technology, and my sponsor said, you know, you go to work and your job is to fit yourself to be of maximum service to those about you, and being of service to others doesn't stop when you show up at work. And so I focused, you know, on doing the best job I could. And what happened was one day was they needed someone to coordinate the technical support for the Office of the President, which was not a part of the organization I worked in. But the head of the organization said, I want Sam to go in there, and I want Sam to be our person in that office. And they trusted me with things like the president's password. And, you know, and I remember when my job changed and I got to walk into that office, I thought, how do I get here? You know, how do you get from being someone who is, you know, a bad employee to being someone that they trust at the highest levels? And all I could think of was that it's because of the principles of this program, having a sponsor and doing things that I don't want to do because other people know that they are the right things for me. And today, you know, the while I was in graduate school, I met, we had a big flood in Iowa, and they needed people to sandbag down by the university. And I remember, you know, well, be of service. I'm going to head down. I can lift a sandbag. I'm going to go down the sandbag. And then there was a woman I met at the sandbagging line, and we were, we were both trying to take charge, actually. I don't know if you ever sandbag rivers, but this is the only place where I've ever been where there's actually more worker bees than like generals. You know, you actually need people to direct. And I thought, you know, well, I'm an Al-Anon. I like to be in charge. And she was actually trying to be in charge. And we met. And a few years later, I decided to go back to church. And I walk into the church, and she's there. And I notice her, and every time I go to church, I look to see if she's there, and I ask my sponsor, I say, can you ask out someone who's at your church? So I didn't know, and my sponsor said, well, of course, why not? And one day, the reading was about Bathsheba, and I thought, today is as good a time as ever. and I went up to her, and I asked this person out, and next month we'll be married for 6 years. And, you know, but prior to that time, you know, and Julie talked about this, you know, dating in the program is like growing up in public, you know, and I had to learn about dating, and I had to learn about, you know, being a principled person, and, you know, if things don't work out, that, you know, no one gets the meeting, that you learn how to, you know, and for a while, before Al-Anon, what happened was that I always broke up. I would either send you letters or phone call you or send you an email to break up with you because I've decided it's not work. And the first time I dated in recovery, I actually stuck in with it where someone broke up with me. And it shocked me. And it hurt. And I didn't want to do it again. But my sponsor kept having me, just keep practicing. And I'm very grateful. You know, but being in the program doesn't mean that life is all, you know, that roses and triumphs. I mean, my wife's mother died when we were engaged. She died of cancer, and I never remember feeling that type of pain. And when they were saying goodbye to each other, I ran out of there crying, and I called my sponsor, and because, you know, what do you do? And then my sponsor said to me that, you know, during this time, you be of service to the family. That's all you can do. And so I would drive them places, and I would get them food, and if there was medicine I needed to get, I just did the things that needed to be done. And very often today, these are the answers to almost every problem I have today, is to be of service and to give more than I want to give. And because prior to this program, and even in this program, my answer was always to take. You know, I'm a taker of things and a user of people. You know, what could you give to me? Why aren't you enough for me? And you know, today I have a program that says if I feel like I'm not getting enough, it's really the problem is this is an area where I can be giving more. And the true freedom of being an Al-Anon and this program is that if I follow these principles and if I do my best to give and serve to those around me, whether it's people, and it doesn't have to be the people I sponsor or people in my meetings or it can be people at my job. But I get to feel really good. You know, I get the benefits of that. And a few years ago, you know, I got a really good lesson in this. I was sponsoring someone, and we were. I went to a regular Tuesday night newcomers meeting, and we would meet for. I met my sponsee for dinner that night, and turned out we had a horrible ice storm in Iowa City, and the area where our meeting was, we lost complete power. You know, we found a place to go. We had dinner where there was power, and you know, it's you know, 6:30 rolled around, and it's time to head to the meeting because I was taught, you know, if it's not my home group meeting, then 10 minutes early is on time. If it's my home group meeting, then you know, obviously more than 10 minutes. But so we needed to get there early, so we got in the car, and just by on the off chance, right? Power is completely out in the whole neighborhood. There's not a light on, you know. But we drive up to the church. And I wait in the parking lot there. You know, I'll just wait here. And sure enough, two headlights, you know, come down the road, and someone pulls into the parking lot, a newcomer I've never seen before, and asks, is there a meeting here tonight? And I said, well, there isn't any meeting here, but we can go find one. And, you know, we got into the car, we headed across town to where there was power, and we got out, and we had that meeting and in that. And I don't know if that person came back, but I want you to know that I knew without a doubt that I was doing exactly what my higher power would have me do. And I believe this is what the big book talks about. And there's this great part of working with others where Bill talks about, you know, keeping on the firing line of life, because it's that is that we're where we are safe. And for me, that firing line of life is showing up early for my meetings. It's being near the front door. It's welcoming people that are new to the meeting. It's getting to the front door before when the meeting ends, because those newcomers, if no one stops them, you know, they will be out the door. So it means not turning to my friends. It means making sure that I have everything about me has the attitude that there's room for one more in the meetings, because people did that for me. And if people had not done that for me, I don't know if I would be here today. And so I am very grateful for the opportunity to be here at your convention. I wish you many more years of success, and thank you very much, and God bless.